Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for September 2nd. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading Headlines, Valiant State, and USA Today Headlines. The first article is entitled, A Veteran Storm Chaser Goes After a Monster Haboob. Interstate 10 hummed with cars rushing north towards Phoenix, drivers pushing to get ahead of what was bearing down on them. At the Red Rock exit, just off the freeway, storm chaser and photographer Mike Olbinski was waiting. Commuter engines revved and the desert winds picked up around them. The skies were beginning to darken, but in Olbinski's line of work, timing is everything. Leave too soon and he'd miss the footage he needs to make a living. Depart too late, then he could get stuck. A wall of dust surged forward like a living beast, devouring the horizon. What could be the best haboob of the season, maybe the decade, was forming over the Sonoran Desert. Light broke through the mountains in flickers, then vanished as the storm thickened. It might be even better than it was supposed to be, Olbinski said. His time-lapse cameras pointed to the looming shelf clouds, signaling the storm's strong outflow boundary. After frustrating months of a sporadic monsoon in Phoenix, with most of the major activity focused in southeastern Arizona, storm chasers from across the country descended on a ribbon of highway as the shadows lengthened on August 25th. The forecast pointed to intense storm activity with outflows strong enough to create a towering haboob that could blanket the city. Haboob is an Arabic word for a violent dust storm or sandstorm. Haboobs form when cold downdrafts from a thunderstorm slam into the hot desert floor, spreading out in all directions. A looming haboob is often the first visible sign that a monsoon storm is approaching. The air was heavy. Birds flew overhead, joining desert dwellers fleeing the haze. Dust clung to his skin and Olbinski's shaky hands before the storm even arrived. Finally, he decided it was time to go. He scrambled to pack up his equipment into his green Toyota 4Runner, lovingly named the Monsoon Mobile, Arizona license plate Haboob. There's so much stuff happening, I want to shoot it all, he said. I've never seen a dust storm form like this from that direction. This wasn't just another summer haboob. This was the biggest dust storm Phoenix has seen since July 5th, 2011, the storm by which all others are judged. It would leave thousands across the valley without power, tear down trees, and drop almost an inch of rain across some parts of the region. Hours earlier, Olbinski had been studying radar, wondering if the conditions would really come together to stir up a haboob. At 1 p.m., he began driving south. The models showed towering storms over the Catalina Mountains near Tucson. Olbinski specializes in time-lapse footage as storms develop, so he drove south, scrolling forecasts and radar models to set up his cameras and wait. He turned toward the mountains. The Catalinas look like they're going to go, which is all we really need today for a good dust storm, Olbinski said. Any time I've seen something really good, it's from the Catalinas. I would love a monster haboob today. The clouds and plumes of dust kicking up showed what the forecasts promised. It was just shy of 3:30 p.m., and Olbinski's time-lapse cameras were a steady click, even as the storm chaser paced back and forth, finally letting himself get excited. The question was whether the outflow, The collapsing rush of rain-cooled air would steer north, picking up dust from battered farmland and pushing it into Phoenix. Haboobs are born from these collapsing storms. Their gusts act like miniature cold fronts, bulldozing ahead of the rain and lifting desert soil into the sky. The right storm can lift a wall of dust thousands of feet high and miles wide. The storm outflows can merge and get channeled along the I-10 corridor heading to the northwest, which happened today, said Michael Crimmins, a climatologist at the University of Arizona. The ongoing drought conditions have beaten up the landscape, too, so the wind can pick up soils and loft them into the air as the outflow churns. Obinsky had been here countless times before, but the results varied. That's the nature of the monsoon, a season that promises drama but rarely guarantees it. One evening can end in booming thunder, violent downpours, and raging dust storms. Others can end in disappointment as storms collapse in on themselves before ever reaching the valley. Year to year, also, the seasons swing wildly, soaking the desert one summer and barely dampening it the next. But there are standouts. The storm on July 5, 2011 was the pinnacle, the dust storm of all dust storms, the one chasers hope will return, perhaps surpassing the first. That storm measured about a mile high and stretched about 100 miles wide, consuming Phoenix. It dumped 40,000 tons of dust on the city in about 2 hours. For chasers like Obinsky, the monsoon's fickleness is both a frustration and a thrill. "I always joke I'm 10 minutes late to every storm," he said. "The goal is to be there before things happen. It's tough on the mental aspect of storm chasing." He struggles with missing big storms, choosing the wrong location for a shoot, or getting stuck behind a dust storm with zero visibility. Obinsky has to stay ahead of a haboob just long enough to watch it develop, but not too long to get swallowed up by it. During the stormy season, he and his fellow storm chasers have a pact not to send each other footage and try to stay off social media. "If I go on there and see something, it can eat at me," he said. "It feels like fear of missing out. You see stuff and your heart sinks. You know you missed something and made the wrong decision. But I remind myself that I've seen some really good storms that other people haven't." By 4:02 p.m., a wall of dust was in his rearview mirror. The storm was moving fast, about 45 miles an hour, and Obinsky had no choice but to race north. At Casa Grande, he pulled off at McCartney Road, leaping from his car to set up his cameras as the wall swelled. He wasn't alone. Cars lined the frontage road. Out-of-state chasers leaned against rental cars, and commuters pulled off to stare at the storm. A group of teenagers climbed onto a truck bed, pointing their phones at the horizon. Like millions of others who grew up in the Arizona desert, the weather has always fascinated Obinsky, who's now 50 years old. It started long before he ever picked up a camera. "I think my first love was lightning," he said. "Lightning has always been utterly fascinating to me since I was a kid." He remembers sitting outside with his dad, watching summer lightning arc across the desert sky. He loved how a monsoon storm could drop a temperature from triple digits into the low 80s, transforming the summer air in an instant. In 2008, he decided to try to capture that feeling. He used a cheap point-and-shoot camera and attempted to catch a strike. His first good photo felt like a miracle. He captured a crisp bolt frozen across the sky. Oblinsky sent the photo to Channel 12, and when the station put it on TV with his name, he was hooked. By 2011, he had invested in equipment and moved from still photography into time-lapse, experimenting with lightning and dust storms sweeping across the valley. During that infamous July 5th storm, one of his time-lapses went viral, the kind of cinematic footage that hinted at where his storm-chasing career was headed. Obinsky paced around his cameras at Casa Grande, plotting his next move. "This is not the one to let hit you," he said. Chasing storms is much more about fear of missing out than it is about meteorology. Every choice, stop here or drive further, can mean documenting meteorological history or missing it. "This is really hard for me. I want to get all of it," he said, glancing between cameras and the growing cloud. By 4:42, the storm was overtaking him again. Rain streaked his windshield, dust and water tapped against the glass. He floored it toward Phoenix, weaving through traffic. "I watch a lot of Formula One," he joked. At 4:49 p.m., he stopped at a Gulf gas station on the Gila River Indian community. Engines idled as people abandoned their vehicles to take videos. One woman said she had not seen a haboob like this in years. An employee stepped outside, eyes wide, fascinated by how the dust cloud was moving. Obinsky checked the radar again. It was time for the final destination, the finale. "It's going right for Phoenix," he said as he jumped back into the monsoon mobile. On top of a parking garage at Sky Harbor International Airport, Obinsky set out his cameras one last time. Below, airport workers still moved luggage as if nothing were happening. Planes took off and landed into the haze just before the airport issued a ground stop until the storm cleared. Travelers were at the airport to catch flights, but above them, chasers were rushing to catch the storm. Photographers jockeyed for space, every lens pointed at the same thing, a wall of dust that was about to swallow downtown. "It's just apocalyptic out there," Obinsky said, his voice rising. "This is like July 5th. He called out to fellow storm chasers by name, exchanging hugs and high fives. This was a dust storm 15 years in the making. Storm chasers took selfies, grinning ear to ear. While most Phoenicians took shelter, the chasers put themselves in the heart of the storm. The sky turned sepia, the sun erased. It wasn't supposed to set for another hour and a half, but streetlights flickered on as the sky darkened and the dust finally caught up to Obinsky. The storm ravaged the storm chasers, grit coating their skin as some scrambled to pick up their gear. Obinsky ran to his car while others hunkered down and braved the brutal winds and whipping sand. The monsoon mobile rocked in the wind as Obinsky pounded the center console in excitement. He managed to capture one of the best dust storms Phoenix had seen in years. "This is what I live for," he said. "It's a sight you don't get to see very much, a wall of dust like this coming over Phoenix. I've come to downtown so many times hoping this would happen, and it never does. But today it did, and it makes all of it worth it." For 10 minutes, Phoenix disappeared. Then, as quickly as it came, the storm passed and rain poured in to wash the grit from the air. The sizzling pavement cooled as Phoenix dropped from 100 degrees to 75. By 5:41 p.m., it was over. Olbinski rushed to upload his footage. His work has been licensed for movies, music videos, advertisements, and newscasts. The most impressive? Marvel's Thor: The Dark World, Olbinski recalled, taking eight of his friends to see the movie in theaters. His footage in the backdrop of the film's climactic scene. And as suddenly as a dissipating storm, he switched from storm chaser to father. Though he'd do what he loves for free, he knows he has to make a living with a wife and three children to support. He pulled out his phone and called home. "Just to make sure nothing blows down out there," he told his daughter. "Shut the shed door." After chasing a wall of dust, outrunning traffic, and setting up cameras on a garage roof, he was back to the ordinary worries of being a father and a homeowner in the desert. But for a moment, for the city and Olbinski, the desert had bared its teeth. A storm like this can come once in a decade, and Olbinski, in the right place at the right time, captured it all. The next article is entitled, "Arizona State University and Sheriff's Office Sued Over Hijab Removal." Four women who joined pro-Palestinian protests on ASU's campus last year are seeking compensation after law enforcement officers removed their hijabs during the arrests of dozens of protesters. The July lawsuit argues that multiple officials violated the women's constitutional rights in forcing them to travel to the jail without their headscarves, which are worn out of religious conviction. Attorneys for the four women in the lawsuit said their clients have suffered and continue to suffer mental anguish, physical and emotional distress, humiliation, and embarrassment as a result of what happened after they were arrested for taking part in the encampment. The incident is detailed in a series of police reports obtained by the Arizona Republic, which lay out a timeline of that night as reported by several ASU police officers. Dozens of pro-Palestinian protesters were arrested on charges of criminal trespassing and booked late that night after they erected an encampment on ASU's campus in April 2024. Cases against most of them are continuing more than a year after they were originally arrested. A hijab is a garment that covers one's head and wraps around one's neck like a scarf. It is worn by many Muslim women to serve as a symbol of modesty, privacy, and piety. Maricopa County Sheriff's Office officials directed ASU police to remove the women's headscarves in spite of them being religious headwear, according to the report. ASU police complied. While the lawsuit includes Sheriff Jerry Sheridan as a defendant, former Sheriff Ross Skinner was heading the department at the time of the protests. The filing also lists President Michael Crow and more than a dozen other ASU officials as defendants. Separate attorneys for some of the women previously told the Republic they begged and pleaded with police not to remove their hijabs. Several other community leaders denounced the actions at the time, including Azza Abusieff, the executive director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations in Arizona. "You feel violated, you're hurt, and it's dehumanizing," Abusieff said. "It's part of their identity to wear the hijab. This is a gross violation of the religious rights of peaceful protesters." While the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office policies do not outright prohibit the removal of a person's religious head covering, it does call for reasonable accommodations to be made for removing and searching a person. Any removal of the religious head covering shall last only as long as is reasonable under the totality of circumstances, the policy reads. The lawsuit argues officers could have taken far more precautions in how they chose to remove the hijabs, which remained off for the entirety of the women's trip to the jail and during their more than 24-hour detainment. The women were exposed to multiple men in a way that violated their sincerely held religious beliefs, according to court documents. The issue is also at the heart of a U.S. Department of Justice investigation launched against ASU under the Biden administration in the fall of 2024. The department did not respond to questions from the Republic about the status of that investigation. The complaint cites a separate case made against the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office in the late 2010s, which ultimately led to a settlement between a woman and the sheriff's office. The next article is entitled, Confusion Reigns Over Getting Vaccines. Healthy Arizonans under the age of 65 may need a prescription if they want to get one of this fall's new COVID-19 shots. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration on August 27th narrowed the category of who's approved to get the updated COVID-19 shots to people over the age of 65 and to children and adults with underlying health conditions. Access for others may be possible by consulting with a medical provider. In prior years, the FDA approved the COVID-19 vaccine for everyone over the age of 6 months. It's highly unusual for the FDA to restrict its approval for a drug in this way, California epidemiologist Caitlin Gentilina wrote of the changes August 27th in her Your Local Epidemiologist Substack. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is expected to uphold the FDA's newer definition of who is eligible for the vaccine, and that could happen within the next month. Right now, there's a lot of confusion about who can get the updated vaccines and when, and whether or not health insurance plans will pay for them. The confusion and new guidelines are happening during a summer wave of COVID-19 that has hit the U.S., including Arizona. The most important facts for Arizonans to know right now are that the updated COVID-19 vaccines as of August 29th were not available just yet, though now that they've been approved by the FDA, they are expected to arrive at pharmacies, clinics, and doctors' offices within days. One of the major issues in Arizona at the moment is that without a recommendation upholding the FDA's approval from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, there are some barriers for anyone, regardless of age, who usually gets their vaccines at pharmacies. The online scheduling tools for CVS and Walgreens on August 29th were telling Arizonans one of three things: that the vaccine wasn't in stock, that a prescription would be needed to get a shot, or, on the CVS tool, that a healthy person under 65 in Arizona cannot schedule a shot because they aren't eligible for it. CVS spokesperson Amy Thibault wrote in an August 29th email that CVS pharmacies are expecting to receive the updated 2025-26 COVID-19 vaccines in the coming days. CVS pharmacies expect to begin offering the shots right away in several states, including California. But Arizona is one of 13 states, plus the District of Columbia, where patients will only be able to get the updated COVID-19 vaccine from CVS pharmacists, depending on their age, with a prescription, Thibault wrote. The other 12 states are Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maine, North Carolina, New York, Pennsylvania, Utah, Virginia, and West Virginia. CVS is unable to offer the vaccines in three states at the moment: Nevada, Massachusetts, and New Mexico, she wrote. Adding to the confusion is that Arizonans will be able to get the updated COVID-19 vaccines at CVS Minute Clinics without a prescription, Thibault wrote. In Minute Clinics, health professionals who aren't pharmacists will be able to administer the vaccines. In an emailed statement, Walgreens spokesperson Bridget Sweeney on August 29th wrote that Walgreens is prepared to offer the vaccine in states where we are able to do so, and that, in accordance with FDA approval and state requirements, we will offer the vaccine to all adults ages 65 and older, as well as to individuals under 65 who are at higher risk for severe outcomes from COVID-19, as determined by the CDC. Sweeney did not immediately respond to a question about whether Arizona is one of the states where Walgreens is able to offer the updated COVID-19 vaccines. As of late afternoon on August 29th, it wasn't possible to schedule vaccination in Arizona with one of the updated shots through Walgreens' scheduling portal without a prescription, even for people over the age of 65. Outside of public health emergencies and some other exceptions, Arizona law says pharmacists generally cannot administer vaccines without a prescription unless they are recommended by the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices or formally approved separately by the Arizona Department of Health Services. The Arizona Department of Health Services, as of August 29th, had not provided any guidance for the updated vaccines, nor has it said when they will be available in the state. The state health department typically follows CDC recommendations. The CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices is scheduled to meet September 18th and 19th, and COVID-19 vaccines are on the agenda for discussion. The CDC director typically endorses whatever the advisory recommends, but the agency right now is in turmoil. Among other problems, the White House fired Director Susan Monterez and numerous top CDC officials resigned. The White House appointed Jim O'Neill, currently the Deputy Secretary at the Department of Health and Human Services, as interim leader of the CDC. If you're not over 65, it's going to be up in the air for a while, I think, said Will Humble, who is Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association. It will become more clear as we get into October and November. The thing is that COVID-19 cases are going up right now. Three big questions remain, Humble said. One is that what is the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices going to do? Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in June fired the entire committee and the replacement appointees include vaccine skeptics. The second question, Humble said, is will the CDC director or interim director agree with the committee's recommendation? And thirdly, what are the health insurance plans going to do? Kennedy, on August 27th, announced on X that the FDA had given marketing authorization for those at higher risk and that the new Moderna, Pfizer, and Novavax COVID-19 vaccines are available for all patients who choose them after consulting with their doctors. He did not specify whether patients would need to prove they have an existing health condition that would warrant getting the vaccine. The list of underlying or existing health conditions that would make a younger person eligible for the updated COVID-19 vaccine appears to be undefined by the FDA, which is normal, Jettelina wrote in her August 27th Substack. The CDC list of conditions that put people at high risk for a negative COVID-19 outcome is, for now, the default, she wrote. The list is broad and includes pregnancy, as well as cancer, mental health conditions, being overweight, obese, or physically inactive. Some health experts are uncertain about the documentation that will be required to prove one has an underlying health condition and say it may require a provider's authorization, though Jettelina wrote that it's likely self-attestation will suffice. It's unlikely that insurance will check this against your medical records, but it is possible, she wrote. In the event that someone, like a younger, healthy person, is not within the updated FDA parameters but still wants the COVID-19 vaccine, Jettelina wrote, they will need to get the COVID-19 vaccine off-label. Off-label is a difficult scenario because pharmacists in most states won't give off-label vaccinations. Doctors may be uncomfortable doing them, and insurance might not cover the cost, Jettelina wrote. Dr. Jerome Adams, who served as U.S. Surgeon General under President Donald Trump's first presidency and during the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic, criticized Kennedy on X after the announcement, saying he is putting up barriers to vaccination. Healthy under-65s now need prescriptions at most pharmacies, he posted August 29th. The FDA's narrower approval does mean many people will likely need a prescription to get a COVID-19 vaccine this fall, said Jen Cates, senior vice president at KFF, which is an independent health policy, research, and news organization. It's unclear whether people who are healthcare workers or who have other high-risk professions or who live in households with vulnerable people will need prescriptions to get the new COVID-19 vaccine also, Kate said. What's also unclear is what the cost of the COVID-19 vaccine will be for people who don't fall into a high-risk group, she said. Insurers could decide, we still think the COVID-19 is important, we're still going to cover it for free. They could do that, Cates said. But they could also decide that don't want to provide the vaccine for free to all groups anymore because of what the FDA decided, she said. One possibility is that insurers will require a physician's recommendation before they'll pay for the shot. The bottom line is, where there used to be a universal recommendation where you could just go down to your drugstore, doctor, or clinic and get a free shot, most people will have to have a prescription, some kind of authorization to be eligible, she said. You're listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled, Protests in Arizona Draw Modest Crowds. Democrats held protests across the country on Labor Day, calling on people to assemble under the banner, Workers Over Billionaires. The events drew modest crowds across Arizona. Roughly 100 people gathered in front of the state legislature, many of them loyal Democrats who have regularly attended demonstrations since Republican President Donald Trump took office. In Scottsdale, activists organized a die-in protest, dramatizing the devastating consequences of corporate greed. It was the corruption overtaking our government that brought Ann Snyder to the state capitol in Phoenix for the fifth protest she has attended there since Roe v. Wade was overturned. A homemade sign hung around her neck, "Without the people, oligarchs have nothing." Snyder, 69 years old, says she wants to see the positives in politics, but for the time being, all she can focus on is getting rid of Trump. "Let's just get ourselves out of this horrible cesspool," she said. Liberal groups and politicians have struggled to push back as the Trump administration attempts a sweeping overhaul of government, pushing past many of the country's democratic and economic norms in the process. Democrats, meanwhile, are without a clear leader or a unifying message following sweeping losses in the 2024 election cycle, and their political victories have been few and far between as the Trump administration enters its eighth month. Tim Everhard, 70 years old, traveled to the Capitol from his home in Peoria, toting a sign that lists what he says as Trump's most unforgivable actions, inciting January 6th riot, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, due process for immigrants. Everhard, a veteran, said the administration reminds him of autocratic governments he saw abroad while serving in the Army. A large portrait of the president recently appeared on the Department of Labor headquarters building in D.C. It reminded Everhard of his tour in Iraq, where stately portraits of Saddam Hussein were displayed in the streets. "When I saw that picture, it took me back to Baghdad," he said. Everhart, drawn to the legislature for the fourth time so far this summer, laughed when asked about the Democrats' response to Trump. "What's been the response?" he said. U.S. Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, will call Trump's actions baloney, Everhart said, or he'll attempt to visit the Eloy Detention Center, the migrant holding area trailed by reports of poor conditions, only to get turned away. "The Democrats' response has been weak at best," he said, gesturing to the empty courtyard where the crowd had already thinned to several dozen people, which is a shame. Heather Clark, 33 years old, worries Democrats' messaging lacks coherence. "We have 50 million things that we care about," she said. "There's no singular message." Clark attended the Labor Day protest with her friend, Stacy Delfelder, 53 years old. Both have regularly attended protests since Trump took office. "In the beginning, it started about saving Social Security and Medicare for my parents and education. But it's morphed into something way bigger," said Delfelder, a Texas native. "I always feared dictatorship from him, and now here we are." Whitney Johnson, a retired air traffic controller living in North Scottsdale, attends a rush hour resistance protest against Trump every Wednesday morning. On Labor Day, he held a sign bearing a photo of the president alongside Jeffrey Epstein, the financier and sex offender whose ties to Trump have loomed over the administration. Johnson is concerned about the rise of fascism, not just in the United States, but worldwide. "People don't realize how close we are," said Johnson, 66 years old. Still, he prefers to protest rather than sitting around. "It's almost an anxiety cure," he said. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article entitled, "What to Know on Schweikert Medicaid Cuts." At a time when some of his colleagues are treading cautiously on the issue, U.S. Representative David Schweikert is defending the Republican-led cuts to Medicaid, saying they make good economic sense, and calling concerns on the issue whining and bedwetting. The reforms are projected to cause millions of Americans to lose their health insurance, largely by expanding requirements that enrollees prove they are working or qualify for an exemption. They are also eventually projected to subtract billions of dollars from Arizona's healthcare economy by cutting a tax that the state uses to finance Medicaid. But in an interview with the Arizona Republic, Schweikert, Republican of Arizona, made the case that the reforms are the fiscally responsible thing to do, and that overall they will help fix a system that incentivizes rising healthcare costs. Schweikert said that overall the reforms in the GOP budget bill make economic and fiscal sense. "If you're going to think like an economist, you got to do it from top to bottom," he said in an interview. He argued that the funding mechanism cut by the bill was poorly designed to begin with, that Arizona's expansion of Medicaid, expected to take a hit under the bill, was always meant to be dialed back, and that, on the other side of the ledger, the tax cuts renewed by the budget bill will benefit his district immensely. Schweikert, widely seen as vulnerable in next year's midterm elections, argued the changes should be thought of not as cuts, but as a slowdown of growth in Medicaid. "The program's budget will continue to grow overall, albeit slower than baseline projections." Schweikert said the media's treatment of the issue, such as its focus on hospitals' profit margins, obscures the entire unified theory of financial stress we're actually under. "To right the country's fiscal ship, we're going to have to do a series of difficult things." On the ground, states and hospitals are expected to feel a crunch. The nonpartisan health policy group KFF estimates that the bill will cost Arizona between $26 billion and $43 billion in federal spending over the next 10 years. Advocacy groups have argued the cuts will imperil rural hospitals and clinics by cutting a key source of revenues. Schweikert questioned what percentage of the state's Medicaid expenditures the bill will cut. "The provider tax was always really questionable," he said, "and creates perverse incentives for states. It's solely for the execution of drawing down more federal dollars," he said. Not all Republicans have taken the same tone on Medicaid. U.S. Representative Juan Ciscomante, Republican of Arizona, who represents a Tucson area swing district, opposed the provider tax cut during negotiations over the bill, saying it would hurt Arizona. He's arguing that a smaller pot of money the bill set aside for rural hospitals will help offset the costs, though it's unclear how much of that money will flow toward Arizona. Democrats, meanwhile, are painting an apocalyptic image of the bill. Former State Representative Amish Shaw, Democrat of Arizona, an emergency room doctor seeking to challenge Swikert in the upcoming 2026 election, is emphasizing analyses finding that rural hospitals will face an increased risk of closing and that more Americans will go into medical debt. I'd love to introduce him to the huge number of decent, hard-working people I treat daily in the ER struggling with healthcare costs, so he can tell them that to their face, Shaw said in a written statement to the Arizona Republic. Marlene Galan Woods, another Democrat running for the seat, expressed outrage over Schweikert's choice of words in a fundraising email. He's gone on a radio show and accused the hardworking Americans who are distraught over losing their health care of whining and bedwetting, the email reads. Instead of explaining what he plans to do to ensure rural hospitals in Arizona don't close, or meeting with Arizonans who will be deeply impacted by federal funding cuts, Schweikert is laughing in our faces. Schweikert has signaled he is rethinking his political future. His campaign team has told reporters he is considering running for Arizona governor in 2026. The announcement was met with skepticism from some Arizona political observers. Schweikert has teased the idea of running for higher office before, and his path to victory in the governor's race is unclear. In an August 27th interview with the Republic, he said, at this moment, he intends to seek re-election to Congress. The next article is titled, Scholars Say Israel is Committing Genocide in Gaza. The world's biggest academic association of genocide scholars has passed a resolution saying the legal criteria have been met to establish Israel is committing genocide in Gaza, its president said on September 1st. 86% of those who voted among the 500-member International Association of Genocide Scholars backed the resolution declaring Israel's policies and actions in Gaza had met the legal definition set out in Article 2 of the 1948 UN Convention on Genocide. Israel's foreign ministry called the statement disgraceful and entirely based on Hamas's campaign of lies. Israel has denied that its actions in Gaza amount to genocide and says they are justified as self-defense. It is fighting a case at the International Court of Justice in The Hague that accuses it of genocide. Israel launched its assault on the Gaza Strip in October 2023 after fighters from Hamas, a Palestinian militant group in control of the territory, attacked Israeli communities, killing 1,200 people and capturing more than 250 hostages. Since then, Israel's military action has killed 63,000 people, damaged or destroyed most buildings in the territory, and forced nearly all its residents to flee their homes at least once. A global hunger monitor, relied on by the United Nations, says parts of the territory are now suffering a human-made famine. The three-page resolution calls on Israel to immediately cease all acts that constitute genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity against Palestinians in Gaza, including deliberate attacks against and killing of civilians, including children, starvation, deprivation of humanitarian aid, water, fuel, and other items essential to the survival of the population, sexual and reproductive violence, and forced displacement of the population. It also said the Hamas attack on Israel, which precipitated the war, constituted international crimes. This is a definitive statement from experts in the field of genocide studies that what is going on the ground in Gaza is genocide, the association's president, Melanie O'Brien, a professor of international law at the University of Western Australia, who specializes in genocide, told Reuters. There is no justification for the commission of war crimes, crimes against humanity, or genocide, not even self-defense, she added. The 1948 UN Genocide Convention, adopted in the wake of the mass murder of Jews by Nazi Germany, defines genocide as crimes committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious groups. As such, it requires all countries to act to prevent and stop genocide. The IAGS publishes a journal and holds regular international conferences of scholars studying genocide and is considered the largest academic group in the field. Another group, the International Network of Genocide Scholars, also holds conferences and publishes a journal but does not issue similar resolutions. Ishmael Athawabta, head of the Hamas-run Gaza Government Media Office, welcomed the resolution's prestigious scholarly stance, which he said places a legal and moral obligation on the international community to take urgent action to stop the crime, protect civilians, and hold the leaders of the occupation accountable. Sergei Vasilyev, a professor of international law at the Open University in the Netherlands, who is not a member of the association, told Reuters the resolution showed that this legal assessment has become mainstream within academia, particularly in the field of genocide studies. The next article is entitled, Indonesian Students Defy Crackdown After Deadly Riots. Hundreds of students gathered in major Indonesian cities on September 1st, defying fears of a crackdown on protests after deadly riots on the weekend left 8 dead in the worst violence in the Southeast Asian nation in over 2 decades. Protests began a week ago against the government's spending priorities, such as enhanced perks for lawmakers, and escalated into rioting and looting after a police vehicle hit and killed a motorcycle taxi driver. The homes of political party members, including the finance minister, were looted and state buildings ransacked or set ablaze, in the biggest challenge to President Prabowo Subianto's government since he took office nearly a year ago. On August 31st, Prabowo announced a cut in lawmakers' perks, a major concession to protesters, but warned that security forces would act firmly to control law and order. The heavy presence of military-led security led some organizers to postpone gatherings in Jakarta. However, groups of student protesters gathered in Jakarta as well as in Indonesia's cultural hub of Yogyakarta and the cities of Bandung and Makassar, the site of the weekend's worst violence, in which at least 4 people were killed in arson and mob violence. The gathering in Makassar on Sulawesi Island was close to the local parliamentary building that was set ablaze on August 29th. The president's statement yesterday did not accommodate demands from students and civil society, said the leader of a student group from Makassar State University. The leader, Syamri, who only goes by one name, said students also had other deeper demands, such as comprehensive police reform. Prabowo also struck a defiant tone in the face of protesters' anger against police, announcing he would promote 40 police personnel injured during the violence. "There might be police officers who were wrong, but I don't forget dozens of officers who sacrificed themselves," Prabowo said on September 1st on a visit to a hospital treating injured police. In Bandung, protesters burnt tires, while in Ternate, a nickel-rich North Malacca province, police fired tear gas to disperse protesters trying to break into the local parliament, according to local media. Earlier, students and civil society groups had called off protests in the capital, Jakarta, citing stifling security. The Alliance of Indonesian Women, a coalition of women-led civil society groups, said it had delayed planned protests at the parliament to avoid any crackdown by authorities. "The delay is done to avoid increased violent escalation by authorities. The delay takes place until the situations calm down," the group said in an Instagram post. One umbrella group of student unions also delayed a protest, saying the decision was due to very impossible conditions. Army patrols could be seen on Jakarta's main roads on September 1st. Traffic was thin, with many businesses allowing work from home and schools holding class online. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.